Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Ellen Brown. We're going to talk about an anniversary coming up in a couple of days, well, in a few days, a couple of days before Christmas. We'll call it a lump of coal anniversary. We're still trying to get Ellen on the line. She is traveling, but I know where she is, and we'll get her on momentarily. Yesterday, I left one important piece of business unmentioned. I got very, very involved in discussion with John Cozy, and there are always so many things to talk about. You can never cover everything in one program, that's for sure. So we try to cover as much as we can, but there's one very important thing, and I certainly wrote a lot about it. The so-called Iranian nuclear talks, over the years, there have been multiple rounds of these. I will say very categorically that Iran has bent over backwards to make concessions to Washington and to the West. And for years, Iran was systematically rebuffed. There were two rounds of negotiations in November. The first round ran 3 days, I believe, if I remember right, wound up on the 9th of November. I think I have that date right. And it, well, you know, you never know what has gone on based on the comments, because, you know, you get the usual diplomatic mumbo-jumbo saying they were constructive, or we made great progress, or something like that. Well, apparently they made some progress, and a second round of talks followed in a couple of weeks. They ended on the 24th of November, and when they did, the headline read something to the effect, a historic breakthrough. Well, I wrote a couple of articles, and in one of them I said, hold the cheers. I don't know about a historic breakthrough. The talks certainly ended up on the 24th much differently than they did in any previous negotiation round. Iran gave much more than it got back in return. Probably the reasoning of the Iranian government was better to get a foot in the door than to get it slammed in our face again. I probably would have made the same decision. But absolutely, the West got the better of the deal. Iran got the short end of the stick. But what's going on? A six-month interim agreement was decided on. So the agreement on the 24th was merely a stepping stone toward what Iranians and any sensible person would hope would be a final agreement 6 months or so down the road. Will it happen? Again, I say hold the cheers, really hold the cheers, because I put out an article this morning that I called Obama Violates Geneva Agreement. The ink is barely dry on the interim agreement, and Obama already violated it. One of the provisions of the agreement was no more U.S.-initiated sanctions. There are so many now, and Congress has been debating more sanctions. In July, the House passed stiffer ones. The Senate had yet to pass a companion bill. It was considering it, and the House was considering even more sanctions. And the Senate, probably some kind of a consolidation bill to match what the House was doing. Well, they suspended that for the moment. They could bring it back in a blink of the eye. The sanctions are illegal. They're all illegal because they mostly target ordinary Iranians. Maybe 80 million of them. International law says they're illegal. You simply can't do what these sanctions have done. Certainly it's harmed the Iranian economy. There's no question about that. But it's ordinary people who've suffered the most. Well-off people get along just fine. Just fine. No problem at all. But millions of Iranians do not. And the idea behind the policy is you get the people angry, thinking they'll be angry at their government, and maybe they'll do something disruptive to get rid of it so America can get another vassal state. The way things turn out historically is exactly the opposite. The sitting government doesn't get blamed. The perpetrators of the human rights violations gets blamed. That's exactly what happened in Iraq during the sanctions years of the 1990s. Saddam certainly was not a beloved guy. But the only person the Iraqis had to rely on was him, nobody else. So with the little bit he had to work with, because the sanctions were so extremely harsh, I wrote a lot about them years ago. I mean, really, really repressive. Human rights violations, absolutely. But the people rallied about Saddam for whatever help they could get. Because without him, they would have gotten nothing. So the Iranians very much support their government. The strategy doesn't work. It's tried over and over again. It never works. And yet the policymakers in Washington come back with the same strategy. And it's Washington initiated sanctions. If Washington didn't do it, the European countries wouldn't do it. They just follow in lockstep, and they add some of their own. But because of Washington's policies, and of course Israel is always lurking in the background. Anyway, the way things stand right now is probably I forgot one thing. For several days there were talks in Geneva that ended a couple of days ago. There were follow-up talks to the late November ones. In other words, there are still details to be ironed out. And both sides are getting together to do it. Well, Iran suspended the talks, walked away. My understanding is they'll be resumed. When and under what circumstances, I don't know. But I'll certainly follow them, and I'll write about them. But the way things stand right now, Washington violated the terms of the agreement. It specifically states, I'll say again, no new sanctions. Well, new sanctions were imposed categorically by executive order, not by Congress, by Obama executive order. There's nothing lawful about any executive orders. There's nothing in the Constitution that says a president can make law by executive order. Ellen, are we connected now?
Yeah, we are.
Oh! I didn't plan to talk about Iran today. I had to get that in, because at the end of the program yesterday, when it was too late to matter, I said, I've got to talk about what's going on in Iran. And I only had about 2 minutes left. There was no time to do it. So I said, I'll sneak in something at the beginning of the program today. And I wanted to get that in, because there's no question that the Iranians are getting snookered again. And my feeling long term is they're going to end up holding an empty bag again. And Washington will blame the victim again, Ellen. That's the way the dirty game works. But let's talk about what you just wrote about. I forget the date, but I think your most recent article, where an infamous, dare I say, a day of infamy is coming up on the 23rd of December.
Right.
Oh, I want to let you explain what you wrote about in your article, but I'll just say this. It's been a while, but I remember writing about the Fed and how in the middle of the night, a couple of days before Christmas, when a lot of members of Congress had already gone home for the holidays, and nobody read the damn bill, and Woodrow Wilson was president. You know, I don't know what he knew about the law, Ellen, but he was a former law professor. He knew something about the law. He signed this bloody thing, and later he said, quote, unquote, I betrayed my country. Well, my God, he knew he betrayed his country when he signed the damn thing. Anyway, let me let you jump in and take over, because you write about we need a Federal Reserve for Main Street, not Wall Street.
Right. So on the 23rd is the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve, and it was always set up to serve the banks, not the people. And so what I was writing about was that even if the Federal Reserve had good intentions, which of course one wonders, they don't have the tools in the Federal Reserve Act to carry out their own mandates. There are two mandates. One is to maintain the stability of the currency, and the other is to promote full employment. Well, they never seem to manage to do that, and they don't have the tools to do it. And they've actually admitted that they don't have the tools. It was an IMF conference in October where Larry Summers spoke. He was Obama's first choice for head of the Federal Reserve, which I think would not have worked out. I mean, it would have been a disaster from my point of view. And he stepped down, I guess, because of criticism. But I mean, or he withdrew his application. But he said at this conference, he said they've dropped the interest rates as low as they can go. They've done all this quantitative easing, and still unemployment is high. And too high. And so they may have to drop the interest rates to below zero. So this is the way they think, that the interest rate is the way you fix unemployment, and if it's all the way down to zero and isn't working, you have to give it even more. In other words, it's not working now, so we have to give it more. It reminds me a lot of conventional medicine, where they hit you with this heavy-duty drug and it's not working, and they say, well, we need to give you more drug. Maybe, arguably, the drug was not addressing the disease. So this raised it. So a bunch of other economists agreed with that, like Paul Krugman applauded this approach and different. I saw one article where it said it just showed that he would have made a great chairman of the Federal Reserve because he's a great thinker. But what that means, if you put it into negative interest rates, it means that we have to pay the bank to hold our money. So, of course, people aren't going to put their money in the bank. They'll put it under the mattress or buy gold or something. And the proposed solution to that was to make all money digital, so you wouldn't have the choice of pulling it out of the bank and putting it under the mattress. If you want to have money, it has to be in the bank, and they, therefore, can take not only some portion for the privilege of storing it there, but they could do bail-ins, et cetera. You know, they can very easily take their haircuts whenever they allegedly need to. So that, to me, was obviously a bad idea, and it looks a lot like the New World Order, one world currency, that sort of thing. Many conspiracy theories were floating around about that. So there was another professor that spoke at that same conference, Ken Rogoff of Harvard, who came up with, I thought was a much better idea. He said, what if we gave everybody an account at the Fed? Like, we all would have an ATM card and we all could use the services of this great credit machine that is supposedly the public credit. And then John Lounsbury expanded on that in Econ Intersect, his blog, and said we could have we could take that farther, and we could have postal banking, for example, and service the 25% of the population that doesn't have bank accounts at all and that are being ripped off by payday lenders and so forth. And then I wrote that the Federal Reserve did do commercial lending for a period of 24 years, starting in 1934, and that worked out fine. They lent to any of the Federal Reserve branches could lend to businesses in their area, as long as they, you know, were solvent good businesses. And it seems to me that they could have or should have lent to the state and local governments, and that was actually proposed after the 2008 collapse. It was proposed by Obama that there should be a facility for the state and local governments, just like there was for the banks, to borrow at 0.25%. Why not? Why shouldn't municipal governments be able to borrow at these extremely low rates? I mean, they are the government, and the Fed is the government, supposedly. It's all one system. Why can't they have access to the same cheap credit that we set the Federal Reserve up for in order to make that available? And again, Ben Bernanke resisted that idea, even though they had lent like $16 trillion to the banks, so obviously they can come up with however much money they want to. So it wasn't that they had a shortage of money. He said no, because he didn't have the tools. It wasn't in the Federal Reserve Act. He's not allowed to lend long-term to state and local governments or to anybody else, basically, except the banks. So that's what I was proposing, that they could, at the very least, some people say audit the Fed, end the Fed, et cetera, but at the very least, they should amend the Fed. They should amend the Federal Reserve Act to give it the tools to do what Congress has told it to do, which was to promote full employment.
Absolutely. And, of course, the Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act. It can amend it. It can do anything it wants to it. I mean, it can transform the Fed in any which way it wants legislatively, even though bankers control the Fed. Absolutely, they own the Fed, and they certainly have full control over it. But Congress, legislatively, having created this monster, can certainly change it into something much more benign. Ellen, it was sometime I pulled up an old article I wrote, And there was a paragraph in it about the Fed that went something like this, not too long. It said, under the Federal Reserve System, we've had rising consumer debt, record budget and trade deficits, a soaring national debt, a high level of personal and business bankruptcies, millions of home foreclosures, high unemployment, loss of the nation's manufacturing base, growing millions in poverty, an unprecedented wealth gap between rich and poor, and an unstable economy lurching from one crisis mode to another. And, of course, we've had terrible inflation over the years. A 1913 dollar isn't worth a plug nickel today, and that's putting it mildly.
Yes, agreed on all that. So, and agreed that Congress could, I mean, it's in the Federal Reserve Act. The last, the very last section says that this act can be amended or rescinded at any time. But the problem is that the Federal Reserve is controlled by Wall Street, and Congress is controlled by Wall Street. So whether they would actually do any amendments is, it seems unlikely. And
well, I call
so
it mission impossible, Ellen.
Like Larry Summers speculate on controlling interest rates. They seem to think that's their only tool is to lower interest rates. Well, that hurts the people and helps the banks, because particularly with these interest rate swaps, that gave the people, I mean, sorry, it pushed interest rates so low that all these municipalities wound up owing the Wall Street rather than the reverse on the interest rate swaps, and that's one thing that helped bankrupt Detroit, among other cities. So they're not serving unemployment. They're actually creating unemployment with those interest rates.
Well, they really are, and I've said many times in this program that the phony 7% plus unemployment, that's the headline number, the so-called U3 unemployment number, there's a U, there's a U6, and there's long-term unemployment. And long-term unemployment, based on the way it was calculated in the 1980s, is over 23%. That number's been repeated many times in this program, and it's an accurate one. If we calculated unemployment the same way we did 30 years ago, it would be 23%. That's depression. Level,
yeah, I think it was
era.
25% in the Depression, wasn't it, 1930s?
Yes, yes. The economy was a lot different because it was very agrarian back then, and I don't know what the situation was for farmers. I guess if you're a farmer, you plant or you do whatever you can, but unemployment, I think, hit a high of about 25%, and now we've got 23+. And the jobs that are created, the one thing I didn't know that Paul Craig Roberts mentioned in his most recent article, the most recent one I read, that if a person has two jobs, you know, you starve to death on one, and you can barely get by on two. But if a person has two jobs, it's counted as two jobs if that person comes up in the survey, in one of them. I think it's a personal survey,
really?
Not the household survey. Although I may have that backwards, I'm not sure. But I think it's a personal survey, because that's the low ball, 7.1% or something unemployment rate. And, I mean, if a person is working, they need to bring in income. What's the difference if they have a day job, an evening job? As far as they're concerned, it's just a way to get enough money to be able to survive. But it's counted as two jobs. And if they have a third one, it could be just, I don't know, a few hours a week or whatever. I guess it would be counted as three jobs. I've known a few people that have had multiple jobs. So if they come up in a survey, they're getting multiply counted. So that alone distorts the number of jobs created. And even the Department of Labor says, and I forget the precise number, but it's something on the order of the number the headline number they come out with, which is revised several times at least, is plus or minus several hundred thousand jobs.
Wow.
That's right on. I haven't checked the Department of Labor website in a while, but I took that right off of their website, plus or minus 200,000 or 300,000 jobs, whatever the number was. I mean, it shows if you create 200,000 jobs, it's possible there were jobs lost.
Yeah.
And the other important thing, too, Ellen, the jobs that are created, most of them are not high-pay, good-benefit jobs. They're low-pay temp or part-time jobs with poor or no benefits. That's the state of today's America. And Paul Craig Roberts has written so much about this, the offshoring of America's good jobs, turning America into an economic backwater, certainly for Main Street.
Yeah. Well, the way to create jobs is to give everybody a job, ensure everybody a job, and just actually literally create jobs, things that need to be done like they did in the 1930s. But everybody's afraid that that would be inflationary to pay them money and advance them credit or whatever, but it wouldn't. particularly if they're productive jobs, if they produce goods and services, that increases your GDP. So you need the money supply to go up along with GDP just to keep the price level stable. But because we have this great fear of inflation, Congress does not use the tools it has. It's really up to Congress, not the Federal Reserve, to create jobs. But what the Federal Reserve could do would be to make make credit available at very low interest rates. For example, for students, the Federal Reserve could give students loans at 0.75% to open the Fed's discount window, just like it gives those loans to banks. And the argument is, well, banks are a good credit risk and students are a bad credit risk because they don't have a job when they get out of school. They've got nothing. And in today's market, they might continue to have nothing. But so guarantee them a job. This has been done in other countries, and it worked. Costa Rica did it starting in 1949. That was another article I wrote recently. 80% of deposits in Costa Rica are in publicly owned banks, and they love their publicly owned banks because they're very safe. While all the private banks keep going bankrupt, the publicly owned banks are by definition guaranteed by the government. They don't need FDIC insurance. But that whole system was set up in 1949 when they had a civil war. The country was desperately poor, and the people rebelled. And the winner of the civil war realized that if he was going to maintain peace and keep that from happening again, that he was going to have to make some provisions for the people. So he nationalized many industries, and one of them was banking. But he guaranteed people a job, which meant either you could work for the government in one of these jobs that in the nationalized industries, or you worked for some sort of contractor. So that a large percentage of the people were either directly or indirectly employed by the government, and that worked. It became the most the richest country in the area. In fact, it became so rich that whenever they did the statistics on production, they would have two sets of figures, one with Costa Rica and one without for the Central American countries, because they were so far ahead of everybody else. Well, it was largely this sort of socialized system that they had. Another thing he did was there were a couple of attempted coups and one attempted assassination. So he got rid of the military altogether. I mean, these were military related. So he just got rid of the military. So just think of all the money the government could save if it didn't support the military. That would be like half our tax bill right there. So he used that money for social benefits. So they have a very good health care for all and education for all. So they have good social services, even though in the 1980s, they got crippled by this 20% interest rate like everybody else. So they were forced into some privatization, but they still have that very strong publicly owned banking system and quite a few public interest industries, I think.
Well, that would be a wonderful system for America, Ellen. As far as education goes, we're talking about military expenditures. I have an article coming tomorrow. I titled "Making the World Safe for War Profiteers." Well, I mean, America spends such a ghastly amount of money on militarism, and the so-called Annual Defense Authorization Acts. That's just a part of it. There's so much more spent. If you include all categories, including the black budgets for 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, we've heard of a country that has 16 intelligence agencies. Well, America has them. I mean, those are the ones we know about. Maybe there are more that we don't know about, but they all have black budgets, so we don't know how much money goes to them. We see published figures every now and then, but I don't believe them. I think just countless tens of billions of dollars gets poured into this stuff. NSA is only one of them. But I guess you call the FBI one. But CIA, obviously, the military, all branches of the military have them. You've got a DEA has them, has one. And other branches have intelligence services. And you've got everything for Homeland Security. Billions of dollars go in to supposedly to keeping us safe, Ellen. I call it Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, America's National Gestapo, which is exactly what it is. And so much more. Interest on the national debt, which is very, very small percentage-wise compared to what it was when interest rates were higher, which they will be one day. I don't know when, but they will be. And so much more that gets poured into this thing. So the headline defense number is really not a small. It's probably less than half of what America spends annually on so-called defense, including homeland. And it probably comes to maybe something on the order of maybe $1.7 trillion, not the headline $600 billion or $700 billion. So that's the number that you see and gets promoted. But so much more. What on earth do we need? America doesn't have any enemies, Ellen. What do we need to spend all this money for?
Recreating enemies because of our military.
Oh, absolutely.
And one reason that the people don't object to that whole system is that it creates jobs. In fact, that's our largest national government-owned industry is the military industry. So you can't really get rid of it because you would get rid of all these jobs. That would be the argument. But what if you turned those jobs into peacetime jobs of some sort? You could still be building things. It doesn't have to be aircraft. It could be trains all crisscrossing the country. It really is pathetic. I'm here in Northern California right now, and I had to drive 3 hours from the Oakland area to get up here. There's no train going up here, and it's a lovely little community. And I kept thinking, well, it'd be great to live here, but look how long it would take you to get down to the airport. Why don't we have a train system that crisscrosses the country like they have in Europe? It's so convenient and so clean, and it's fun to ride. You know, it might be 3 hours, but you enjoy it. You can sit there and look out the window and work on your computer, take a nap or whatever. But we just don't have that because we're so car-oriented. And anyway, there are many things we could do. The things they do build in the way of infrastructure, they have to be new infrastructure. And that's why instead of putting money into repairing the roads, which clearly need it, they're making new roads in places that right here the people are objecting to these bypasses that are just ruining the environment, and there's just all kinds of objections to them. But they have to do it a certain way to comply with what the federal government will give funds for. Anyway, it seems to me there's so much more work that the government could pay for, but they won't do it because that would put them further in debt. But it really wouldn't. You'll be creating jobs, which will create taxes. In a good economy, the velocity of money is about 7. That means that the dollar changes hands 7 times in a year. So if each of those people that gets the dollar, you know, the grocer pays the rent and the landlord pays for clothing, et cetera, each of those recipients of the dollar pays on average 20% income tax. You only have to change hands 5 times, and the government has all the money back. But somebody has to put the money out there first before it can come back. And that's the catch, where Congress is afraid to allow any more money to go out there in the form of credit for fear they won't get their money back, or for fear it'll build up the national debt. What really builds up the national debt is interest. Interest is, well, I did the figures for the last 24 years, that's all they put on the Treasury website. If you add up all the interest figures on the federal debt, it came to $8 trillion out of a $15 trillion debt
at the time
I added those up. So that's more than half went to interest. So if we had issued that credit directly, like out of our own Federal Reserve, which rebates the interest to the government, that would have been interest-free. We would have $8 trillion more, at least. And if you go back more than 24 years, we'd have more than that.
It really is an amazing story, Yellen. Absolutely. If the government has plenty of money, it can spend it any way it chooses. And if you put money in people's pockets, they spend it. And if they spend it, it grows the economy. And if the economy grows, then jobs are created. I mean, you have a virtuous circle of prosperity. I mean, it's not rocket science. It could be done. And I think another great investment is in education, which the GI Bill after World War II proved, plus the other benefits, but it put a lot of young kids into college, and the government financed that, and it was wonderful. Literally, it spurred prosperity because of that. We could have these initiatives today, but we have policies that only stuff the bankers' pockets and the other corporate favorites. Let's go back to this as soon as we come back from break, Ellen. We'll take a short one and be right back. Welcome back, talking with Ellen Brown as we approach the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve. Oh, my goodness, how time flies. But literally, I can remember writing how the Congress was, 1 foot out the door, heading home for the holidays. I'm not certain how the breaks were considered back in those days. Usually they break ahead of 2 days before the holidays. They get out of town as soon as they can, unless they're way behind and they may have to get some business done, which does happen every now and then. But literally their minds were on the holidays and certainly not on passing legislation, and they didn't pay much attention, as far as I understand, to this bill. So they were the ones who were there. They also passed it in the middle of the night. So when there's something really nasty they want to get through, they pick a time when nobody's really watching and nobody really, can you imagine the state, the mental, the physical state of the people in Congress if you're passing a bill at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and they've been up all day? I mean, they probably can't even keep their eyes open. So they just want to get out of there and go home and go to bed.
Yeah, and even when people read it, they didn't understand it. William Jennings Bryan was the... led the opposition to having Wall Street create the money of the government, and he said absolutely not. There was no way he would agree on such a bill. And then they changed the name and changed the wording, and he thought that it meant that the government would be issuing the money, but it didn't. What it meant was the Federal Reserve would issue the money, and the Federal Reserve was privately owned, and at that time the Federal Reserve would charge interest. So they're printing our money, lending it to our government, and charging the government interest on it, instead of what William Jennings Bryan thought was that the Treasury would issue it directly and just pay it out for the things that the government needed. So it turned out to be a debt-based system instead of a, where you're just issuing, like greenbacks, just issuing the money directly.
You know, Go ahead.
In the 1960s, then, Wright Patman saw that and said, you all are creating our money and for free, just creating it on your books and lending it to us and charging us interest. He said, that's not right. The Federal Reserve should be nationalized. It should be actually owned by the federal government. And to avoid that, the Fed then agreed to rebate its profits to the government. So now the Fed creates the money interest-free and buys up bonds, which they have to do on the open market. They're not allowed to just buy the bonds directly from the Treasury. So the banks always get their cut in there. And then they rebate the profits. So the cheapest way we can borrow is to borrow from the Federal Reserve. So this thing that everybody's freaked out about with the Fed buying government bonds is actually, I think, is the way to go, because one reason they're doing it, of course, is to keep the interest from going up on the federal debt. The debt seems to keep going up, but the interest stays at about $400 billion, which is about a third of our income taxes. I mean, it'd be nice to get rid of that, but at least it's not going up exponentially the way the debt is. And the reason is that the part that the Federal Reserve buys is interest-free because they return the interest to the government.
Well, we've got this very large national debt that keeps rising while the Fed has been printing or buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities to the tune of $85 billion a month. The debt has been rising at about $1 trillion a year. What is it, 16, 17 trillion now, something like that? Inevitably, one day interest rates will rise, long rates will rise. They certainly were, those of us old enough to remember, certainly remember ghastly high interest rates back in the 1980s, early 1990s. Well, it was wonderful for savers because you could get wonderful return on just a simple money market account or even a savings account. I remember those days just fine. I mean, it was wonderful. It was, guaranteed money as long as you didn't go over the amount that was FDIC insured. But one day, you know, what goes around comes around, and one day we'll get high interest rates again. No time soon, I don't think, but eventually. So what will happen with the interest that's owed on that national debt, Ellen? It would be a monstrous amount then.
Yeah, well, unless the Federal Reserve buys it, in which case, because they return their profits to the government, it will be interest-free. So that's what they should do, is the Fed should buy up all the bonds, it seems to me, which is what they're pretty much are doing now. The way it works, the Treasury doesn't set interest rates according to what the market will bear. The Treasury just says we're going to issue these securities at X interest. And then as many sell as people want to buy, mostly, you know, big funds and so forth. And then whatever is left over, the Federal Reserve buys. And then they rebate the profits to the government. So this all this concern because the Chinese aren't buying our bonds anymore and that's going to drive the interest rate up. It won't. It won't affect the interest rate. It'll keep it down, actually, because it means that the Federal Reserve will buy the excess instead of the Chinese, and we get the interest back, so it's interest-free. So I think all that's fine. I think the Fed should own the whole federal debt, which would be the equivalent of the government having issued it as money in the first place.
Well, I'd like to see the Fed nationalized and have it really be federal instead of private.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That would be wonderful. And, of course, they have a public banking system to go along with it. That would be very, very important. It would be wonderful. Ron Paul, several times when he was in Congress, introduced the Federal Reserve Abolition Act. I think that's exactly what he called it, the Federal Reserve Abolition Act. And I'm not certain he ever got a co-sponsor. If he ever did, it certainly wasn't more than one or two. But you talk about the Congress changing the existing system. I think it literally is impossible to do based on the way things are now, just the way they keep the defense expenditures high. And one thing I would add to what you said earlier, Ellen, was that the way the dirty system works, or one of the ways is that defense plants, big and small, are scattered all around the country in many congressional districts. So the idea that these Congress people can get jobs by having these things in their district, but heaven forbid if they cut federal spending, they will lose these jobs, and that would be anathema to their reelection chances. So it keeps the dirty business going.
Right. So somehow that has to be converted into jobs that are for the country rather than for the military. You know, that's something that serves the local economy.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. There was a man that I mentioned in an article I just wrote on a totally different subject, but a man who I wish was still living today because he'd be a marvelous guest on this program. He was a professor at Columbia University. His name was Seymour Melman. He wrote a number of books on the military-industrial complex. And basically, if there was one theme in all the books, it was that a buck spent in the civilian sector gets much more bang than if you spend it in the military sector. And he showed that over and over again in one book after another. And I read about half a dozen of his books years ago, and I've got them on my shelf. It made so much sense. But if you literally converted this military spending, a big chunk of it, to civilian spending, it would be much more prosperous for the country, for the people living in it. And, of course, it would be a more peaceful world besides.
Yeah, I wonder how, I suppose the same industries will want to get the money. I mean, they'll be lobbying against any such conversion unless they're going to still have contracts. So you'd have to contract with them, but just have them build something useful for the local economy, like trains, bullet trains or something.
Oh, indeed. Instead of building tanks, build trains. Again, you mentioned a wonderful train ride that you didn't get a chance to take. What about having a transcontinental, what's the Japanese thing, a bullet train, I guess it is.
Yeah, bullet train.
I don't know how fast those things, how fast do they go, do you know?
Pretty no.
fast.
I know they're supposed to be building one from L.A. to the Bay Area, San Francisco, but they've just... A court has just determined that they can't do the funding that they had proposed. So now they have to come up with some other sort of funding. And I'm actually running for treasurer on the Green Party ticket in California. And so I was asked to, you know, show how that could be done through a publicly owned bank, a state-owned bank. That's my platform, along with Laura Wells, who's running for controller. She ran for governor before on a state bank platform.
Oh, I wish you luck, Ellen. I wish you luck. You're running when? 2014?
Yeah, so we actually just have till the spring because it's a two, they only allow two candidates on the ballot, so you can assume it's going to be the Democrat and the Republican, unless, of course, something radical happens, like Bank of America goes bankrupt. I'm just rather expecting that, a bail-in of some large bank, which it seems to me would upset people like in Cyprus, and people might think about some radical changes in government.
Well, Bank of America would be one heck of a bankruptcy if it happened. Certainly one of the major banks in the country, probably one of the big four. If I were the president, Ellen, I would want you either as my Treasury Secretary or Fed Chairman, and I'd say take your choice, either one. As a matter of fact, you can have both jobs if you like.
But thank you, President Ledman.
We'd have a wonderful administration, Ellen. We'd probably last about 3 days before they kill both of us.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, so it was suggested that I was going to write an article on how you could fund this bullet train through a state-owned bank. I mean, you would save the interest, basically, so you would cut out probably at least half the cost. But as I looked at it, it just looked to me like the whole thing is probably too expensive. I mean, I don't think it's a good idea. They've already got all these cost overruns in it. The amount that they're going to spend on this bullet train through the desert, where not that many people go, you know, it's not like something that's going through busy metropolises like in Europe. It seems to me that money could be better spent on local transportation that will get people to their jobs or get people to places that are an hour away, like just where I am right now. There are no trains up here. But anyway, you could do it through a state-owned bank. I'm in Northern California right now. I've just given three presentations up here, or I am giving in the Mendocino County area because they're looking to establish a county-owned bank, and San Francisco is looking to establish a San Francisco-owned, city-owned bank. So we've talked to people there while I was up here this week. Anyway, in California, they do these capital appreciation bonds now where they got $9 billion for all these various, mostly school districts. It's the only way they can get money is these loans where they don't pay any interest until 40 years later, and then it all compounds, and they're paying principal and interest. So San Diego contracted to do one of these capital appreciation bonds where they will pay in 40 years 10 times what they got in principal, 1,000%. It's horrible. And that was so outrageous that Governor Brown then signed some sort of legislation that said that they can only do four times principal. But even four times principal, this $9 billion that they've gotten in as the principal amount of these loans, they will be paying $35 billion, you'd think 36, but it's actually $35 billion in 40 years on that. So that's a debt we're imposing on our children, and they're going to be, it's just going to be like the third world, where they're paying these debts that they had nothing to do with. The people receive no benefit from it directly, and they're paying off the debts of their forebears, contracted probably by an illegal government or a government that was not acting in the interests of the people.
It really is a terrible system, Ellen, and the people in office now, they don't worry about the fallout from the bad policies today, because they'll be long gone from office and it'll be somebody else's problem to deal with. The idea that you can kick the can down the road 40 years, I mean, that really is pretty monstrous. But to think of the horrors that could come about under a system like that, I don't even want to think about it. I mean, it seems to, in my lifetime, it doesn't seem so long ago that 40 years in the past existed. My goodness, back in the 1970s, it almost seems like yesterday for me. And the 70s weren't such a great period. Lots of problems, lots of inflation, lots of other problems. But we've really had a terrible time for ordinary people since then, where the rich and well-off, privileged and so on, they've done very well for themselves. But ordinary people have been so badly harmed. And in the new millennium, it's been worse than ever, especially during the Obama years, where literally you've got this terrible situation of growing poverty and unemployment and really human misery that gets no attention in the major media. You know, they talk about economic recovery. What recovery? What recovery for people who are suffering so much?
Yeah, there's two economies. So the stock market has recovered, but it appears it's pretty hard to follow all this. You know, the quantitative easing, that the money that came from the Federal Reserve is just sitting on bank balance sheets. It can't jump that divide from the reserve accounts into the real economy, because that's the only thing you can do with excess reserves is you can lend them to other banks, but you can't lend them into the economy. I mean, they back the loan. Well, anyway, it's a bit complicated, but they haven't left bank reserve accounts. So you've got these mortgage-backed securities and federal securities and cash that's sitting on bank balance sheets. But what they're using it for is collateral in the repo market. So they're actually in their investment wings, you know, the other part of Bank of America and J.P. Morgan, where they have $1 trillion in deposits, which all goes into this pool, and then they're allowed to gamble with that money because it's considered the bank's money. So anyway, they're using that money in their excess reserves as collateral to borrow for their own account, and then they use that money to buy stock or other sorts of investments. So they're buying up all this stuff. The banks themselves are buying stuff up using credit generated from these excess reserves, although the reserves are still just sitting there on their balance sheet, so it doesn't look like they've gone anywhere. They definitely haven't gone into consumer loans that help the local economy. What they've gone into is the stock market. So that's driven the stock market up, and it appears to be recovering, so they call that a recovery. But they're not looking at the homeless on the streets, which for whom things have not gotten any better, and they're in places like Detroit, they're obviously getting worse and worse.
Well, they sure are. I mean, Detroit is really a zombie city, and there are other cities in America, smaller ones, including a number in California, as I think you know, Ellen, that have gone bankrupt. Stockton, I believe, San Bernardino. Some smaller cities have gone bankrupt. It's been a while. I wrote an article about them some time ago. And in the richest country in the world, you've got cities going bankrupt. Well, occasionally that happens. If you go back a lot of years, there have been cities that have gone bankrupt. But we really have maybe closer to an epidemic of this stuff happening now. And to have it happen to a city like Detroit really is absolutely outrageous. The industrial capital of America, along with Pittsburgh and steel, back 40 years ago, 50 years ago. I mean, these cities, literally super cities. And I lived in Pittsburgh working for a steel company for a short time in the 1960s. And the steel in Pittsburgh is gone. But Pittsburgh successfully reinvented itself, and Detroit didn't. So we have this debacle going on there and all the misery that goes along with it. But in a city like Chicago, I live downtown, you can walk out in the street and in the wintertime and freezing cold and see homeless people, too many homeless people, crouched in hallways. And, you know, they slept the outside overnight. And how they can survive a Chicago winter outside, I just have no idea. But this is the plight of many people, and nobody cares. Nobody does anything. They're on their own. In the daytime, they sit with a tin can, and they ask people to contribute a dime or a quarter or whatever so they can get something to eat. But can you imagine surviving that way? And this goes on all over the country.
Yeah, and it's shocking to Europeans that come here because they do take care of their homeless. I mean, we really are a sort of a brutal country in that way. In Detroit, what I've written on this recently, that it was the interest rate swaps that were one of the factors that put them into bankruptcy, and into the counterparties on these swaps are big banks, of course, and they have a perverse incentive to actually put a company into bankruptcy, such as Lehman Brothers. That's what happened there, where the derivatives players go first in a bankruptcy. This is the law under the 2005 Bankruptcy Reform Act. And so they get to grab all their collateral, and then whatever is left over is divided up by all the other claimants, which would include public revenues. So I know the governments think, well, we're secured, you know, we're secured creditors, so we'll be all right in a bankruptcy. But that's not true, because the derivatives people go first, even before the public, before the government revenues, and they'll take whatever they're owed. So if you had another big bust like the Lehman Brothers collapse, wound up costing the government $700 billion in real money, not counting what the Federal Reserve put up in credit. So if you had something like that cost $700 billion, The FDIC only has $32 billion in it, the FDIC insurance fund. The Dodd-Frank Act says that in the event of another derivatives bust of the nature of the Lehman collapse, we, the people, will not be responsible. So the FDIC fund can't borrow from the Treasury to get that money or to get more money. So the individual depositors plus the public depositors, everybody's going to be out of luck except the derivatives players that go first. So that whole thing should be totally changed. But the reason they've set it up that way is that is what runs the whole shadow banking system. That in the conventional banking system, you have FDIC insurance, and that's why you have deposits, which is what creates your liquidity. Well, they needed some sort of similar insurance in the shadow banking system, and so this was this guaranteed collateral thing where in the repo market, whoever is holding the collateral gets to go snatch it at the time they call a bankruptcy. It's like musical chairs, and if you happen to be holding the collateral, then it's been rehypothecated and rehypothecated. They're lending our money as collateral into some other gambling thing, and whoever's at the end of that chain gets to grab the collateral and declare bankruptcy. That's the way the game is played.
What do you think of the Fed tapering? Do you think it's going to come in 2014?
It seems to me it wouldn't hurt them to taper the quantitative easing, certainly on those mortgage-backed securities. What the concern is about the interest rates. If they raise the prime rate, it would, it seems to me it would bankrupt J.P. Morgan. Well, J.P. Morgan has, I think, $33 trillion in interest rate swaps. They're the counterparties, so they're the ones betting that interest rates will be low. And so if interest rates go up, they're going to owe a lot of money. I think that would bankrupt them, and so they probably won't do it for that reason.
So you think Janet Yellen will keep the gravy train going?
Well, she might cut back on the quantitative easing, but I doubt that the interest rates are going to go up.
Yeah, I doubt that the short rates will go up. Of course, long rates are independent of the Fed, and they certainly have been rising, not dramatically yet, but considerably. I think the last year, percentage-wise, I think they made a pretty good jump. Of course, coming off a very rock-bottom level, 10-year treasuries, 280 plus, something like that, 2.80 plus. I mean, my God, I remember in the 1980s buying a treasury note, and I think it might have been for 5 years. I bought a few treasury notes. I know I bought at least one for 10 years, but I may have bought some for 5 years as well as 10 years. But I remember distinctly buying a treasury note that paid me 15% interest. I thought that was marvelous.
Wow.
15%
yeah.
interest. I mean, government money that seemed perfectly safe to me, paying me
right.
guaranteed 15% interest. And, you know, the prices on these go up and down. If you want to trade them, you could make extra money or lose money. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to buy them and just hold on to that 15% interest until it matured. Then hopefully it would still be 15%. Well, as I went back, I know it wasn't 15%, but a few times I bought were all double-digit or close to it. Even maybe 9% was the lowest. I mean, I'm considering what you get now. You get nothing today, but imagine getting that kind of return.
Yeah, but and then where does the money come from, though? You can see why they quit doing that.
Of course, the market will determine the long-term rate rather than the Fed. And at some point, maybe the bond vigilantes that certainly have not been around for many years, maybe they'll come back one day and decide they will keep raising rates. It'd be interesting to see what they are. End of 2014. I get ahead of myself in articles, Ellen, and we're getting short on time. I want to give you a quick last comment, but I'll just mention one thing. I do get ahead on articles. I have one I haven't put out yet. I will shortly. I call it Bracing for an Eventual Day of Reckoning, and I include some forecasts in it. Gerald Celente thinks that we'll have a real debacle in the marketplace sometime either in March or by the end of the second quarter, 2014. He made the same prediction in 2010. He said he missed it. He was wrong because of quantitative easing. They just kept coming and coming and coming and coming, and he didn't expect that. Well, maybe there'll be another surprise, so we just don't know. 2014 could be trouble. Maybe it won't be trouble. But I think it was interesting to throw his prediction in. Quick last comment.
Okay, well, I'll just give out my website. So publicbankinginstitute.org has lots of information on public banking, and then my articles are on ellenbrown.com, and I have over 200 on them on there.
Oh, thank you so much, Ellen. Enjoy your stay up there. The people you're meeting with, I'm sure, appreciate you very much. I look forward to getting you back next month.
I likewise.
And happy holiday to you.
You too.
Thanks, Ellen. Join us next week, Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.